Thank you, Nalanjan. This is nice and cozy, so we can hopefully I won't take all my time, so if there are any questions, we'll have time for that. I think in oncology, personalized oncology is here today, really, in terms of treatment planning based on somewhat individualization for patients. The readout is really about the biology of the tumor when it comes to treatment rather than the germline polymorphisms in predicting susceptibility to disease, probably the oldest biomarker, predictive pretreatment biomarker of that type is estrogen receptor, used in breast cancer for selecting anti-estrogen treatment. But there's a growing list, and it's growing fairly rapidly in terms of mostly single gene, single protein, single gene mutations, amplifications, translocations, and a targeted treatment that goes along with the detection of that mutation. But in general, it could be either a single gene or protein leading to sort of a treatment indication or a scalar index or classifier. There's been a lot of publications on using gene expression scores that summarize the contributions of expression levels of a large number of genes. Mostly is for what we will talk about as prognostic markers. And the sort of motivations for it are sort of obvious. One, most cancer treatments benefit only a minority of the patients for whom they're administered, certainly most drug treatments. And being able to predict which patients are likely to benefit can help patients, can help control medical costs, and I would say improve the success rate of clinical development. Not necessarily, as some people say, make clinical development quicker, cheaper, but doesn't necessarily make it simpler, but I think it can improve the success rate. One example of this was a couple of years ago, I think in 2009, it was there was an ASCO press report when it came out there were two anti-EGFR antibodies that had been approved for the treatment of advanced colorectal cancer. One was called cetuximab, the other was called panitumumab, and it came out that these antibodies were really only effective for that indication if the patient did not have a mutation in the KRAS gene. And that was pretty well validated with using randomized clinical trials, although not completely prospectively. Nevertheless, I think it was internationally accepted that there was strong evidence for that. And someone did an economic analysis of it and found that in terms of the cost savings for using KRAS testing to limit the use of cetuximab, one of those antibodies, advanced colorectal cancer it was estimated that it would save something like $604 million per year in the U.S. alone. So there can be big cost implications. So we'll talk about predictive markers and prognostic markers. These are sort of jargon terms, but they're pretty well embedded in the therapeutic literature now. Predictive marker is used to mean a pre-treatment biological measurement that helps identify who will or will not benefit from some particular treatment, usually a drug treatment. Whereas a prognostic biomarker is a pre-treatment biological measurement that indicates long-term outcome for patients either untreated or receiving some standard treatment. There's a huge literature of prognostic markers and prognostic factors, and usually in this literature, not much attention is paid to treatment. and assuming the treatment either doesn't play much of a role or the prognostic markers are studied in the context of maybe reflecting both characteristics of the disease and in the presence of either a treatment or a variety of treatments. And so, but nowadays when people are trying to use these markers really to direct treatment, to really do that well, you have to be much more specific about prognostic marker under what treatment. And in some cases, prognostic markers have been used studying patients who are receiving essentially a minimal treatment and to see who needs more aggressive treatment or who doesn't need more aggressive treatment. I think when talking about markers is this concept of clinical utility, which is, I think, a very important concept. It's also an ambiguous term, but what I mean by that is a prognostic and predictive marker have utility if they are actionable, if they are actionable for informing treatment decisions, and in a manner that results in patient benefit. So there's a huge literature of prognostic markers that are almost all or never find their way into being ordered in medicine, in oncology, or being used in practice. Very few of them are recommended for measurement by the American Society of Clinical Oncology. And because they're not really very actionable. Myself and Jyothi Subramanian, one of my postdocs, did a review of gene expression profiling and signatures in early lung cancer, and which of these looked like they were ready to be used. I'm not going to go through all of the aspects of that paper, but I just wanted to say one thing in terms of developing these prognostic gene expression signatures. The fundamental problem is really the fundamental problem of all the entire prognostic literature, and that is an inadequate focus on intended use. Cases selected based on availability of specimens rather than relevance for intended use, winding up with a heterogeneous sample of patients, and too great a focus on sort of regression modeling to try to figure out which marker or which variable is prognostic or independently prognostic, but not really looking as to whether, for example, the marker defines a subset of patients for whom a different treatment, you know, who do not need aggressive treatment, who have such good prognosis with minimal treatment that they don't really need more aggressive treatment. And so I saw, you might say, a quote from Yogi Berra, that if you don't know where you're going, then you might not get there. And that's really, I think, accounts for a large part of the discrepancy between the enormous published literature with gene expression profiling and the fact that not many of them are actually used in practice. Prognostic markers can be therapeutically relevant. Probably the best example is this Oncotype DX recurrence score that was developed from the start to help inform treatment decisions for patients with node-negative ER-positive breast cancer who receive surgery and maybe radiation and originally tamoxifen, to identify with that specific treatment which patients had such good prognosis that they might opt for no chemotherapy or such good prognosis that the absolute benefit that they could receive from adjuvant chemotherapy would be minimal. And so this was a good example of deriving a gene expression signature in which the patients were selected for that intended use and the data was analyzed in that way. Now let's switch to predictive markers and some issues of clinical trial design. I think predictive markers and doing clinical trials to try to identify with new treatments who actually benefits from these new treatments is, I think, revolutionizing oncology treatment development today. And so, you know, to recognize that basically cancers of most primary sites, so not all, represent a heterogeneous group of probably different diseases. that vary fundamentally with regard to the mutations that cause them and their responsiveness to specific drugs. And so we have this standard paradigm of clinical trials, broad eligibility reflecting the broad set of patients who might ultimately be treated with a given drug, and focusing the analysis on testing the overall null hypothesis of no average treatment effect, and being very skeptical of any subset analysis. This, in some cases, leads to treating many patients with few benefiting and having small average treatment effects, problematic for healthcare economics. It's actually now problematic for many of the pharmaceutical companies who, in some cases, get their drugs approved, but because the average treatment effects are so small, they can't get payers to pay for the drugs. So they are now very motivated to trying to develop their drugs with companion diagnostics so that they can have large treatment effects. And I think this standard paradigm sometimes leads to a lot of inconsistency results among studies, and in some cases probably it has led to false negative studies. At the same time, the traditional post hoc exploratory subset analysis, we all know, is very error prone and really is not satisfactory as a basis for predictive medicine. So really the challenge is, how can we develop new drugs in a sort of a prospective manner more consistent with the heterogeneity we know from tumor biology, and obtain reliable information about what regimens work for what kinds of patients? And how can we do it in a way that really provides the kind of reliable answers we expect from phase three trials? And I think there are many sort of sub categories where different kinds of approaches are useful. One extreme, when the biology is clear, you can develop a classifier of the patients likely to benefit from the drug and establish an analytically validated test for measuring that classifier, and then use that test to screen patients and only include patients in that trial who were test positive and are likely to benefit from that treatment, and then do a randomized clinical trial of those patients. And usually this would be has been used in situations where the classifier is based on a single gene or single protein product, which is sort of the target or a target of the drug. For example, this was the trial that was used for trastuzumab, Herceptin. And the test, although not a great test, was used to screen patients whose tumors overexpressed the HER2 receptor. Usually this will be used when there's a strong biological basis for the test. In those cases, I think there's potentially even an ethical issue of exposing test negative patients to the new drug, because although you can be wrong about the marker, usually if the biology is strong and you think you really understand it, then exposing patients, test negative patients, to a potentially toxic drug, patients who you don't expect to actually benefit from the drug, is not something you usually want to do in a clinical trial. Now, we published a couple of papers looking at the efficiency of this targeted design compared to the standard design, where you just wouldn't use the test at all. And basically, when less than half of the patients are test positive and the drug has little or no benefit for test negative patients, even if it has, if it's half as effective in test negatives as it is in test positives, the targeted design requires dramatically fewer randomized patients. So this sort of general approach is almost the thing that has the greatest impact on the efficiency of clinical trials in terms of the number of patients. And it's because the number of patients you need, or the number of events you need in a clinical trial, is usually basically approximately dependent on the reciprocal of the square of the treatment effect you're trying to detect. And so any sort of increase in that treatment effect you can make by targeting the right subset of patients has a major effect on the number of patients you need. In the interest of time, I'm gonna have to skip some of the slides, like this one, showing an example of how it had a dramatic effect on that Herceptin clinical trial. We have actually on our website web-based programs to sort of let you try out these designs and compare to the standard design. Now, in many cases, the confidence in the classifier will be less compelling, so you basically will have a clinical trial design in which you're prospectively trying to learn how does the treatment benefit, if there's any at all, relate to a test, and you're trying to do that prospectively, but you don't have the biology or the behind it to sort of use that test for excluding patients from your clinical trial. The key thing really in this kind of a situation is to have a pre-specified analysis plan that probably evaluates the treatment overall as well as in your test positive subset, and to protects the type 1 error for those multiple comparisons and sizes the trial so that you have adequate power in the subset. And there's various kinds of analysis plans you could use, and this publication went over some of them. I will post these slides on that website so that anybody who's interested can look at it in a little more detail. And we also publish a design for where you have one predictive biomarker, but you don't really have a cutoff for it. And so where you're not going to restrict eligibility, and at the end you're going to use some kind of analysis that looks at the multiple potential cut points for that marker and takes into account in the analysis that you are looking at those multiple cut points. And we got things like not only protecting the type 1 error, but getting bootstrap confidence intervals for treatment effect as a function of the level. Now, in many cases, the biology is not so clear that you're going to have just a single predictive biomarker. There's a large international effort ongoing to sequence large numbers of human tumors of each histologic type, and basically finding that many tumors generally contain a large number of mutated genes. Nevertheless, in some cases, the tumor retains sensitivity to inhibition of a key mutated oncogene. So even though you might think of, well, gee, the situation must be hopeless if you have all of these mutated genes, some of those genes are sort of are what's called passenger mutations and are not really driving invasion of the tumor. Some of them are, in some cases, you see what people have called oncogene addiction, where the tumor retains very substantial sensitivity to inhibition of a single mutated protein product of a single mutated gene. Nevertheless, it's not always easy to detect whether a mutated gene drives the invasion of the tumor. There's a lot of interesting things going on right now with using RNA interference to sort of identify in cell lines what are the key targets, what are the key targets in the presence of one drug, so as leads for how to go about combining drugs, and even trying to phylogenetically reconstruct using deep sequencing of a single tumor, multiple subclones of a single tumor, to try to phylogenetically reconstruct the evolution of that tumor and figure out what are the early mutations. The early driver mutations may be the best targets. So there's really, I think that's a big challenge today, is to sort of to try to understand what's coming out of these DNA sequence tumor sequencing studies. Nevertheless, there are, in terms of clinical trial design, I think new oncology drugs are being developed. They're almost always molecularly targeted these days. You generally know something about, you generally know their targets, or you think you know their targets, but many of them are kinase inhibitors, so they have multiple targets. And it's not the simple situation of just where you have it narrowed down to sort of one candidate biomarker. And so we have, myself and some of my collaborators have developed other designs for sort of multiple predictive candidate biomarker settings for developing a new drug in that context. And I won't not going to go into any detail on those designs, but I wanted to mention something about the sort of framework we've adopted for these designs, because it's really not the traditional multiple testing framework where you have lots of subsets and you're trying to look at treatment effect in all of these subsets and control multiple comparisons. I don't think that that's really the right framework for structuring these designs, these clinical trials. And so the way we've done it, we say, well, you'll measure these, you'll biologically characterize the tumor for the patients going into the trial, and then you will try to, and then you'll develop an analysis plan prospectively, and that analysis plan will sort of have two main objectives. One is to sort of test some null hypothesis that the new treatment compared to the control is uniformly ineffective. By that I mean it won't necessarily use just average effect. This is a single test that may be involved sort of covariates and interactions and things like that. But it's one test, so there's no multiple comparisons there. And if that that test is sort of protecting the type 1 error of the study. And if you're able to reject that null hypothesis, then the other thing, objective, is to sort of develop a classifier of patients who you think benefit from the new treatment relative control versus patients who don't benefit from the new treatment relative control. And I call this either predictive classifier or an indication classifier. It's a different kind of classifier, and we go into it in those publications, one approach to sort of developing that classifier. But basically, we're viewing this as sort of, in large part, protecting the type 1 error and then a classification problem. And what you require is good characteristics for this classifier, that you wind up with an unbiased estimate of the treatment effect in classifier positive patients, and the trial be sized so that you can develop a good classifier if there is one. So in summary, I think new technology makes it increasingly feasible to personalize oncology. Targeting treatment can provide important benefit for patients, for medical economics, and for the effectiveness of drug development. Achieving this potential requires, I think, some paradigm changes in clinical trial design, away from the standard broad eligibility, single null hypothesis paradigm. Biomarker development must focus from the start on intended use. And I think we have to remember, because it's all when you start talking about classifiers, and if you're not going to have an infinite size clinical trial, your classifier is probably not going to be perfect and you're not going to have all the characteristics you want. My own view is that new methods don't have to be perfect in order to be major improvements over what we use today. The final slide, I just wanted to acknowledge all of my many collaborators. Thank you. Yeah.
What you talked about, the need for sample size. What, give us an idea of how big those sample sizes need to be and whether that's realistic in the present or whether they need to be an order of magnitude or half an order of magnitude bigger.
Yeah. Well, I think with the in the simplest situation where you have marker, but you're not going to do just in it, where you're going to have test positive and test negative patients, then you have to size the trial is to have adequate power for the test positive patients at a reduced significance level, since you're probably, since you're protecting the overall type 1 error, there's going to be some reduction in the significance level. It's not usually the examples I've worked through, you don't require an enormous increase in the sample size, because your assumption is that if you can focus on the test positive patients, you'll have a larger treatment effect than what you've been expecting overall. Like with Herceptin in node positive breast cancer, it reduces the hazard of recurrence by 50%. And seeing similar things with other drugs. So I think with issues of where you have multiple biomarkers and you're developing classifiers, I really am not able to answer that question yet.